The Helicaster Jane Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast always available online at HelicasterJane.com. Welcome to the Helicaster Jane Show. This is Helicaster Jane. Let's talk. Susie Faber-Hamilton went from star athlete to high-priced call girl for the three-time Olympian in women's distance running, wife, mother, real estate agent. The simple life wasn't enough. Susie Faber-Hamilton tells her shocking and inspiring story in the New York Times bestseller, Fast Girl, A Life Spent Running from Madness, and here on the Helicaster Jane Show. From Olympian to call girl, Susie Faber-Hamilton. In our first half hour, and in the second half hour of the Helicaster Jane Show, our fun, fabulous, brilliant panelists featuring Sheila Weller, Lisa Schifrin, Susanna Andrews, and me, bringing up the rear. It's our Four Broads talking segment, in which we dice and dissect all things election 2016 and more. So stay tuned. But before we begin, the Helicaster Jane Show is brought to you by our new partner, Kobo, for all your e-reading services. And remember, the Helicaster Jane Show is always available online at HelicasterJane.com. Susie Faber-Hamilton is a three-time Olympian for women's distance running. Growing up in Wisconsin, in a seemingly normal home which wasn't, she began running at age 9. Singularly focused on her running career, excelling in her efforts, life on the inside wasn't what it appeared on the outside, and winning for Susie would come at a cost. Battling eating disorders, a lack of self-esteem, and undiagnosed bipolar disorder, she was harder on herself than even the legendary coaches she met along the way. When her career ended in spectacular fashion, after falling at the 2000 Sydney Games, and she no longer had that outlet her competing afforded her, the demons came flooding in. This led Susie from star athlete to a life as a high-priced escort in Las Vegas. Wife, mother, real estate agent, the simple life wasn't enough for Susie Faber-Hamilton, who became her alter ego, high-priced hooker, Kelly, who she might still be today had she not been outed by a journalist. Let's talk.
Listen to me. You know, if you didn't read it, who would believe it, right? What a story you have to tell. But I want to start at the beginning because I want people to understand from whence you came to how you got where you got. You had a pretty idyllic childhood from the outside looking in, but the fact of the matter was that things weren't all that wonderful in your home. You want to tell us a little bit about growing up?
Sure. I became like the child prodigy at a very early age, always winning races, so successful in my running career, but which started to add pressure to my life. I also had a brother who was bipolar, who demonstrated incredibly destructive behaviors. And as a child, I didn't know what bipolar was. I just knew my brother had this illness. I didn't understand that the brain was diseased, that the brain was actually sick. But I saw the one episode that I saw that was very destructive was him passed out on the floor with the empty vodka bottle. The entire bottle was empty. And he had a shotgun in his arms. And I, as a child, 12 years old, seeing this, it was very traumatic. And I had no idea why my brother would be such a bad child, is how I thought of it. Why is he being a bad child? Why can't he just snap out of it? I had no idea that the bipolar had this gripping effect on his brain, that he was out of control because of the brain being sick, just like a body organ having cancer. It was the same thing, but I wasn't educated to know that at the time.
You know, when there are secrets in a family and there's silence in a family, nothing ever gets told the way it should, and nothing ever gets, therefore, processed the way that it should. And I think that you do say in the book that there was a lot of lack of communication and silence in your family about all of this, correct?
Correct. I think that was also part of the Midwest generation. We didn't talk about our problems. It's easier just to move on, because if you actually have to talk about your problems, that's painful. And it's easier to not have to deal with that in many ways. Growing up, that's what we did.
Okay. So running. I love the first scene of you running. Running, the minute you started to run, you're like a gazelle kiddo. off you go. This really does. I mean, this just touched something inside of you. Maybe some of us who try and run and never are successful at it don't get. What happened that first time that you really felt that feeling?
You know, it still kind of gives me the chills because it was such a defining moment. I remember just running on the trails by my house, feeling like I was a gazelle or a deer, just almost floating, kind of out of body. Was I really running this fast? Because I felt fast, but I didn't feel like it was much of an effort, like I was floating through the sky. And that's when I discovered how it made my brain feel. You know, I lit up with a smile when I was running. It wasn't painful or a struggle. It just came natural.
Right.
But unfortunately, that didn't stay long. Once I started winning in high school, the pressure came in and the anxiety was gripping.
And I think that is so important to your story, to anybody, any of us who get into a pursuit of something, the dangers of pursuit. I want to explore that a little bit further with you as we go along. But you did sense a feeling, a high, and you did a sense of self-power, probably because of this extraordinary ability that you had. Is obsession a word that you would put into this childhood pursuit of excellence?
Completely. Yes, completely. I was so obsessed. I developed an eating disorder also in high school because I was so obsessed with my body looking a certain way, and I saw myself as not the skinny, anorexic-looking runner. I saw myself as big, which I was 100 pounds. I was really small, but I couldn't see it, and I felt I had to be thinner to be faster. I didn't even realize the damage I was doing to my body at the time. It took a very bad injury in college, and my boyfriend, who is my husband now at the time, to basically tell me, you either get help or I'm not going to be in your life anymore. It was this ultimatum to change, to get better.
You were anorexic and bulimic, right? Both.
I was bulimic.
Bulimic.
You know, as much as I wanted to not eat, I would get too hungry. And I would eat, and then I would eat enormous amounts and feel awful. So it was easier to have that control to get rid of the food. It is about control.
Oh, for sure it's about control. And having had my own little tiny battle with anorexia when I was in college, I can really relate to it. I can also relate to this bizarre, we don't know what we really look like thing that goes on with all of that. But in your case, you're running. How the hell did you get through? Where did the energy come from when you're not eating properly? That fascinates me. I would have had no energy to even begin to pursue what you began to pursue.
It's amazing the runners that suffer from anorexia and bulimia. I tell young runners, if I'm speaking to them, you have a 2-year window span to keep up this behavior. Then your career will be over. And it doesn't last longer than 2 years. The body can only go so long being having malnutrition. And injuries happen, your bones get brittle, you break bones. It's a destructive path. So I was able to get through it basically for 2 years, and that's when the injuries started popping up,
right.
Stress fractures, and I was heading down a really bad path. I was on my way to making no Olympic teams.
Let's talk
about it. And I didn't realize it's a mental illness.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. And it's all got everything to do with power, and it's interesting that women seem to suffer from it far more than men. I always think Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry for cutting in. To bring up the fact that my body, I felt it didn't look a certain way, and I had the reinforcement from my coaches, which was just awful. My college coach read me a letter he got from a woman, and the letter said, I think it's important for you to tell Susie that she should wear 2 bras when she's running because her boobs are bouncing too much. And then in college, I had a gentleman... I don't even call him a gentleman. I had a man on the men's track team filming my breasts secretly as I ran. And the only reason I found that out because he was showing another athlete on the men's team who happened to be a friend. Nothing. He was fired, but never an apology from the university. Nothing to me. It was like it didn't even exist. And here my mind's being warped even more that I don't look like the runner And then I have another coach in my professional career who tells me I can't have sex the day before a race or the day of because I'm going to deplete my testosterone. It's like all these men were controlling me and telling me my body needed to look away, a certain way. So honestly, with the boob thing, I had a reduction because
really
people were yes, because the outside world was telling me I needed to look a certain way. I'm standing out too much. My boobs are the focus. And so I basically cut my boobs off, and I felt like, okay, now I'm a runner. Now I look a certain way.
Well,
obviously,
yeah.
By doing that, I couldn't breastfeed my baby. You know, there were consequences.
Sure. You know, it's interesting to me because, you know, this conversation, you know, everybody wants to hear the salacious side of what happened. I want to talk to you a little bit more about the Olympics, about kids who are training for the Olympics, kids like you who get focused very early on, and then the system gets a hold of you. And I do think that's a conversation that is necessary to have. What you went through in your training, I think, has a lot to do with what happened to you later. Just trying to grab back some of that control that all of those coaches and trainers and everybody had a piece of Susie. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
No, absolutely. My running career had a huge effect on what would happen to me later in life because I didn't medal at any of the Olympics. And my third Olympics in 2000, I was the one who was going to get the gold. I had just run the fastest time in the world. It was me who was going to change the sport. By winning the sport, by winning this race, I could actually bring attention to track and field, and we wouldn't be aired at 3 a.m. Maybe we would be aired at 7 p.m. So people were telling me, you can help to change the sport. And I just felt so much pressure to win and anxiety. And with 100 meters to go in that race, three girls passed me, and it was like gold, silver, bronze. Those medals just flew right by me. So instead of failing in my sick mind, I fell. I just told myself, fall. And I fell so quick. And you can see the video on YouTube, and it looks really real. So I'm like, oh, I'm a good running actress who can fall. But that particular race was the downfall because my entire career was based on that one day. And so I felt like a failure.
Well, I actually think you felt like a failure before that, and you were fighting that feeling of, I am not worthy, I am not this, I am not that, all the way through your whole book. I mean, the book is just riff with all of that. I thought it was fascinating, and I can certainly relate to it being an overachiever type like you are. And I think it goes hand in hand.
You're so smart. Yeah, you're so smart.
Well,
you're exactly right.
Well, I'm smart now. I wasn't smart and made all the same mistakes that you made to some degree, you know, here, there, or wherever. I think we all do, unless we are lucky, like you were really lucky. Think about it. You know, everybody could say, oh, my God, look what happened. But the other side of it is, at the long and the end of the day, you're lucky. You beat it. You fought it. You won it. But that insecurity, that thing that people who put on overachievers, who we put on ourselves, I think that has a lot to play with all of this, as well as what the system does to somebody like you in that Olympic hierarchy. And I just don't think you can tell a story like this without telling that, too. I also think there's a confusion that can happen between mental illness and good intent for the bearer of the mental illness. I think that's a key. You're thinking all along you're doing the right things, and in a lot of ways you were hurting yourself.
Absolutely. I was self-destructing and causing this harm to myself because I didn't have a voice to speak up and say, you know what, maybe I don't want to be doing this anymore. Maybe I want to have a different life. I want to go out with friends. I want to experiment, whether it's sex or drinking or do what kids do. I never had that life. I'm not saying that people should go out and drink and have sex, but a lot of kids in high school do that. And I never lived a life like that. It was so structured. And
you never had
so
a childhood.
Driven.
You had no childhood. That's
exactly.
Yeah, you and all these kids that you look back, you know, the Mickey Rooneys and the all the actors who had, you know, great childhoods as actors and success, but they had no childhood, and it comes back to bite them later. You can't overstep a major part of development without it having, you know, consequences that are huge, and as they did for you. So listen to me. Like I said, we get to the part of the story that to me is just, oh my God. But let's start with Mark, your husband. husband who you met in college, and you guys get married. You have a daughter.
Yes. In 2005, we had the daughter, and I spiraled out of control after having her. I was misdiagnosed. After I had her, I was in a really dark, bad place, and I went to the doctor, and basically she diagnosed me as having depression and gave me an antidepressant that would take care of my depression. And what happened was this antidepressant set me off in a manic state. I had no inhibitions. I remember feeling no inhibitions whatsoever, talking a mile a minute. I started to spend money that I normally wouldn't just go out and buy random things, but I was starting to do that. Crazy, stupid things that I didn't even need. And we started to, my husband and I, talk about our 20th wedding anniversary coming up, and we came up with two bucket lists. Let's do something crazy. And I was on this antidepressant for 2 months, so I was starting to feel that craziness. And I said, let's jump out of an airplane. And he agreed. It was something we always wanted to do, but I never could have done it. But that drug made it so I could. And then we decided to have the threesome, which I always tell people, you have no idea how many people do this, but it's just never talked about. It's, you know, their own little secret, their private life behind closed doors. But the threesome set off a behavior in my brain, a manic episode where I felt so alive and euphoric. And I remember the lights were all bright and sparkly. I write about that in my book. And I knew that I wanted more of that sexual exploration.
You know, you've been on such a high your whole childhood. It's high. You're every race, you get that high thing going. And then you're not racing anymore, so the high is gone. You get into the mundane. A lot of us find it difficult to live in the mundane, right? I mean, it's a hard place.
Right.
It is a hard place for some people to stay, whether they're manic or they're not manic. We all want excitement a little bit in our life. It's interesting to me how this one manifested itself for you, though, in the sexual aspect of it. You know, sex is such a funny thing anyway, you know, in every aspect that you look at it, you know. But I don't know anybody who wouldn't say that naughty, dangerous, whatever, that they're power-filled, sex-filled, that there isn't some drive to that for anybody in any circumstance. I mean, you know, all those wonderful books that became the movies, you know, which is about, you know, what is it called? I can't think of the name of it. My head just went nuts, you know.
The 50 Shades?
Yeah, 50 Shades. I mean, the whole world is reading that.
Yeah.
Every woman in the world is reading that book. Now, you say, every woman, even in Oshkosh, Bagosh, Wisconsin? Come on, what does that tell you about society? I mean, it tells you a great deal about society. In your case,
exactly.
Though, it's true, right?
So they're starved for this sexual content.
Right.
That's why my story made such big headlines. But yet, you did that, you can't do that. But yet, we want to read about it.
Right, right, right. Which tells you a whole lot about society if they were honest about it with each other, which you and I are being right now. Everybody's going to probably go, oh my God, those girls, don't let them get together. But this is, I think it's a fact. I mean, I really, really do.
Yes.
And I think you have to be honest with it about it. But in your case, you became, quote unquote, a high price call. We're all high prostitute, call it what you will. This is what I think is so fascinating, because I do get this. It brought you a newfound confidence. You started taking control of Susie, and it presented itself an opportunity. And you cannot tell me that you didn't understand, this is my call now. I'm going to run the race. I'm going to make the story the way that I want it to be. I'm going to win at the end. I'm in control, not the parents, not the brother, not the sister, not the coaches. Tell me if I'm not right about that.
You are 100% correct. I had the power. I could take care of my own life. I made my own money. I had this enormous thrill from it. I could look any way I wanted, spend as much money as I wanted. I was at the pinnacle of what I thought was success. I felt like I'm living that movie star life, but I didn't realize the level of craziness that was going into this. I mean, it got so bad with the sexual part of being an escort that even other escorts were talking to the agency about me, and I didn't know this. but telling the agency she is out of control. Something's going to happen to her drastically. And these are the other escorts who are talking about me. Like I said, I had no idea how out of control I was.
Understandably, but why didn't your husband put his foot down about this? Why didn't he understand, try and take some control about this? Why did he go along with that? I have to ask. It's just curious to me.
That's a great question, in that when I started it, we discussed having an open relationship because our marriage wasn't going well.
Right.
So the open relationship kind of gave us permission to explore. He did see a woman, an escort, and I kind of pushed him in that direction, I think, to take the guilt away from me, saying, okay, he did it, so that's okay, I can do this. And with us not getting along, this became my happiness. This made me feel so good that I wasn't telling him what was going on. I told him bits and pieces. I'd come back and tell him about so-and-so, and he just got disgusted. He didn't want to hear about it. But then there were things that were so spiraling out of control that he only found out when I wrote the book and he was reading. He's like, oh, my God, I can't believe you did that. I had no idea. Why didn't you tell me? And I said, if I told you, you would have pulled me out somehow. And, you know, he tried on his own to pull me out. But at that point, he lost all control. And he thought that I would live one life and he would live another life. And he could raise our daughter most of the time. And I would be in Vegas doing what I was doing. So we almost had, we did have separate lives at that point. And he bought me a condo in Vegas, which I know a lot of people can't understand that. But he just wanted to make me safe because he knew he had tried and tried and could not get me out.
Amazing. I have to ask you one question about the sexual aspects of this, and that is, in the book, it seems that every man was rich and kind of handsome and cute and adorable, and I'm sure that isn't exactly how it went through the whole entire experience of it. You know, in that role...
That's true.
Well, of course, in that role... Do you get off yourself, or has it zero to do with sexual pleasure for you and it's all about control? I know every woman in the world wants to ask me to ask that question. I'm asking.
I would, you know, in answering that question, and my husband had asked me that particular question too after the book came out. And for me, it was more about the control. I mean, there were certain clients that it was an awesome sexual experience. But the majority of the time, it was me taking control of these powerful men who their lives, if it was a CEO or a famous athlete, their lives were running the ship, meaning they took control of everything. And then when they would come and see me, they could surrender that and I would have control. Whether I held them down or whatever I did, it made them surrender. And they wanted that in their life. They wanted to just surrender everything.
I believe that's true. I think that's why they do it with call girls, because they can't get away with that at home. They can't do what they really want to do without, they lose that thing. Should we shame all call girls? You know, you give a reason for what happened to you, but I want to ask you. You know, now you're in treatment. Now you're, you know, it's not, I'm sure, not always 100%, but you're a whole lot better fit mentally than you were at the time. But, you know, could you see yourself doing this again? And or should we be shaming call girls? Or, you know, are they entitled to do what they choose to do?
Right. For me to do this again, I would be going down a dark path. I don't have the hypersexuality that came from that drug that I was taking. I mean, all with hypersexuality, all I could think about was sex, 24/7, just having sex, because it numbed me. So without that drug, I don't feel the same way towards sex. But going back into that world, I know that that would be something that would trigger my mania. So if I go back and have crazy sex, I'm going to have to take it to another level, right, and another level where it's going to be destructive. But I also realized in looking back, many of those women had it under control. There were some that clearly did not, who were snorting cocaine just to get through the appointment. But there were a few that also did it because they enjoyed it and they loved the benefits. They loved, you know, the cash. They could go away for a weekend and come back with $15,000.
Right. So if they're geared for it, have at it, girlfriend, and the rest of us should leave them alone. Listen to this also, okay? There are two parts of the story that I have to do, and we only have a few minutes, but let me do first your daughter, because I can just imagine that after all the story comes out, not because you wanted it to, but because a reporter got wind of it and blah, 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 there you were. Okay, your daughter. What in the world do you tell your daughter? Do you live with, oh my gosh, I hope I didn't permanently damage her from all of this? That would be the, you know, your husband's a big boy, he can handle it, your family, but your daughter, talk to me about her.
You know what, my husband was the one who started the conversation. We both went to see a child psychologist because she is our main focus in life. You know, we're adults, we can handle this, we'll work through it. But what we told her, first of all, she was seven. She knew that something was not going on. She knew, why is mom wearing a wig right away after this? Why are they crying when they're talking to their parents? So she definitely knew something was wrong. And we told her, listen, your mom did something that was not right for her. It's okay for some women to do what your mom did, but for your mom to do this, this was wrong. So we wanted her to know, you don't slam people. You don't judge people right away. And we told her that your mom had a bunch of boyfriends. That was how the child psychologist wanted us to present it at first. She knows now at age 10, she knows that I had a threesome with her father. And I told her, you know, couples do this all the time. Not every couple, but a lot of couples do this, and it's okay. We're adults. We make that decision. And she was, you know, she's totally fine with that answer. And we've educated her that I got paid to have sex for I got paid to have sex, and that when I was doing this, my brain was actually sick. My brain was not in a healthy place. I wasn't thinking about being a mom or a wife. I was just doing what I could to make myself happy and please myself. So she totally understands it. And she is so open. If she has a question about sex, she'll just ask us. Or she'll tell us, so-and-so just said this in the classroom. And I'm like, oh my gosh, Kylie, you know that is so inappropriate. And she's like, I know. That's why I wanted to tell you. So she tells us everything. And we tell her, you know, that kid is out of line. He shouldn't have said that. But we're so glad you tell us, because then we can talk about it. And it's okay.
Back to the Olympus and a level of excellence that people in our country, our society have today. Talk to me about this very quickly, because we only have a minute or two, but I really got to get this in, because to me this is really key in every way. We athletes today are paid fortunes of money. You know, they're grabbed early on and their childhoods are taken away like yours were. What are we doing here? Is it all worth it? Is it okay just to run? Because that's something you enjoy.
Is the parent doing it for themselves? I think is the main question. And I think many times when you have an athlete at such a high level, that the parents, there's some type of pushing, or the parent is too involved in thinking how it reflects on them and how so and so in the neighborhood is coming up to them and saying, "Wow, your child is really good." Or I think there's a lot to do with the parents, because they're pushing too hard. And you just let your child be, let them grow. You can encourage, but don't be living through your child. It's the worst thing for the child. They will grow up and rebel and resent you for that.
Things good now, sweetie? Are they better?
Yes. Things are so much better. I have my bad days. I can't paint everything with rose-colored glasses, but I'm doing good, and I have two loving people that mean the most, and that's my husband and daughter, and we're really tight, the three of us, and that's all that really matters in life, and that's what my father-in-law told me when the story came out. He said, you have everything in the world, even though you're seeing this destruction from the media. you have your husband and your daughter. What else do you need? I'm like, thank you so much. It was the best words of wisdom he could give me.
Susie, I love you. Thank you, darling.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks so much. You're
sure,
awesome.
Thanks. You are too, babe. I've been speaking with Susie Faver Hamilton, author of Fast Girl, A Life Spent Running from Madness by way of Day Street, an imprint of William Morrow. For more about Susie Faver Hamilton, visit SusieFaverHamilton.com. You're listening to the Hallie Kesser Jane Show. My guest today, Susie Faver Hamilton, author of Fast Girl, A Life Spent Running from Madness, and Susanna Andrews, Lisa Schifrin, Sheila Weller, and me, our panel of four broads talking. We'll be back in a minute. Stay with us. And we are back on the Hallie Kesser Jane Show. Thank you for being here. Okay, folks. Yep, they're back. Here's this week's edition of Four Broads Talking. In case you don't remember from last week, our ladies, or broads, we go both ways, are Sheila Weller, Lisa Schifrin, Susanna Andrews, and me, Hallie Kesser Jane. I'll be joining in as well as moderating. Okay, here we go. We are Four Broads Talking.
Okay, my fellow broads. So
okay.
Nice to have everybody here. For those
yes.
of you who don't know who they are, because it's the first time you come in on this segment, I want to introduce everybody. I first want to say hi to Susanna Andrews, and she's a writer for Vanity Fair. Say hello. Give us that gorgeous voice.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Okay. And then our gal writer. I call her gal writer because she always writes about these wonderful women, and her name is Sheila Weller. Say hello, Sheila.
Hello.
And then we all together laugh, ha, 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 because we're going to say the great line and our resident conservative.
Conservative.
Ha, ha, ha. Yeah, why aren't you? You never laugh, Schifrin. You never laugh. Her name is Lisa Schifrin, and she's a panic. She's the funniest person in the world. Except when she's talking about conservative issues, and then
she's
not
very
so
smart
funny.
When she's talking about that.
She's smart about that.
Yep.
She does loses her sense of humor. But anyway,
love
we love her. We all love each other. Can you all tell? We are the best. So let's get going, because really, again, what a crazy week this has had. I mean, this is nuts. So let's talk election 2016, because honestly, in my opinion, and I'm old, could it be any crazier than this? Can anybody remember anything quite like this? Don't tell me yes, because the answer is no. The conventions are over, and it looks like Hillary Clinton got the best bounce. Some say as much as 9 points.
Really?
That's exactly
great. I didn't
right.
know it was that high. Wow.
At that high. And at the state level, where this will be decided, because, you know, these national polls won't mean anything in a few minutes, she's even up in Utah, which I think is a perennial blue state. And Donald Trump, in my opinion, Lisa, listen to what it's my opinion, made a complete spectacle of himself from his ongoing loathsome comments to the Khan family, the parents who are Muslims, whose son gave his life for his country, to calling Hillary Clinton the devil herself, right? And long way around, is this guy becoming unhinged, Lisa? I'm asking you, was he mentally ill? Is he out of control? His own campaign surrogates are leaking that they can't control him. Talk to me.
Well.
Me. I started you on that. But I love you.
I'd say he's out of control. There's no question. And he certainly is impolitic. And he seems undisciplined. And he says stupid things. There's just no way around all that. What he says about in these kind of Twitter and personal conversations versus policy is a different issue. You know, I think he just shoots off his mouth, and I don't like that any more than anyone. I do think that when somebody stands up on a stage at the Democratic National Convention and personally attacks a candidate, uses the legitimate and honorable grief that any parent has who has lost a son in combat in this country, to attack a candidate in such an odd way, then really there has to be a way of answering. In a good campaign, a surrogate would have responded. Trump would have been able to be dignified. And that should have happened.
Okay, so let me interrupt you, because I do want to get into that, but I want to do that on its own part of its segment. So let's just stay with this, because a lot of people are starting to say that maybe he is unhinged. Maybe he isn't mentally stable. You know, I'd like to hear what everybody else says. Sheila, you have a point on
that?
Well,
I felt this for a while. I didn't think, other than the two things we are going to talk about, Khan and the Melania thing, which I'm dying to talk about, I don't think this has been a different, more unhinged week than any other weeks. You know, how is this night different than other nights?
How is this week different than other weeks?
He's
said the same things. It's always about me, me, I'm this, I'm that. You know, I'm not aware. You're more in the know than I am that this is a more unhinged week than he's had before. I mean, I think his behavior has been the same. He's talking me, me, me. He's shooting off his mouth. It's all narcissism. He's very thin-skinned. Aside from the two very big things that happened this week, the Khan situation, which got criticism, attracted criticism to him that hadn't happened before, strength of it, and the Melania pictures, I don't think he's any more unhinged than he's been, any more unconventional than he's been. So,
okay, unconventional is your word. What do you think, Susanna, real quick?
I think he's been Donald Trump. I think we've been Donald Trump, and I think we've seen him under pressure, but he isn't a different Donald Trump than anyone in New York who has been exposed to for, what, 2-3 decades? I mean, if I'm going to diagnose him, I would say he had mild narcissistic personality disorder. Has he been more unhinged? I think he's been under more pressure. And I think the value in this experience, if people are watching, is that they get to see what his judgment and his temperament and his leadership qualities are when he is under pressure. And the pressure was a little bit more tense this week.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, because I think if in electing a president, people can't just look at ideology. They have to look at behavior. And in this instance, wow, 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 such outrageous behavior, according to the President of the United States, by the way, who today said, and I quote, that he is unfit to serve as president, the president of the United States of America, in front of a foreign person, by the way, said Trump is unfit. And you know, what astonished me about this is, and this is the question really, is that even something a president should say? Now, we know he's trying to defend and get Hillary elected for his third term, but he is still a sitting president.
I think that was an appalling thing to say. It was a breach of any presidential stature, which should be outside of partisan politics. Of course, he's a Democrat, and of course, he is helping Hillary, and of course, that's his goal, to get her elected. But to come out and say something like that, which is actually a matter of opinion, I think that's undignified, and I think it suggests a certain fear and hysteria that I'm interested to see. You know, Hillary may or may not be getting that bounce, but nobody's showing up to see her on her little bus tour.
Can I say something?
Yeah, you can. This is Sheila. Sheila.
Oh, yes, Sheila. The word undignified and Obama just don't go together. I think he's dignified no matter what he does. I'm sorry, I sound like a groupie.
You are.
What surprised me about this is that he used this opportunity to say that. I think that was injudicious. I think it's interesting enough that what has gotten Donald Trump, what has gotten a criticism that hasn't stuck before, is a angry Muslim American man criticizing. This has lasted and lasted and lasted. That's surprising to me. That's a surprising thing to happen of all the people to get Donald Trump. And I think Obama, given the vulnerability he has, people saying he's Muslim, not only that, I mean, obviously he's not, you know, he is who he is. He's a Christian. But people saying, well, he had a Muslim parent, well, he, you know, is sympathetic to Muslim countries, which one could or could not say. I think this was an odd choice of a venue, of occasion to say he's unfit for president. I think this was a risk.
Okay, Susanna?
I think it is because what he did is so unprecedented and unpresidential. That's the reason why it's so important. I don't know how many of you actually saw him make the remarks didn't just read them, but it was very clear that he was aware that he was treading on dangerous territory, that it was very, very sensitive. I thought his whole demeanor was thoughtful, considered, pained. I think he spoke with feeling. And to me, that he spoke at all speaks to the gravity of the situation in America.
And that's what I would add to that, because what I would say to that is this is the most measured president we've had in decades. And for him to make that statement, you know darn well he had thought about it. He didn't just do it flying off the cuff. And he must really feel, as president, not as Barack Obama, and I think that's where maybe some of us are wrong, that he felt, because of what had just gone on in this last week, particularly with the Khan family, that he needed to say that. I thought he took great personal risk on that, and I don't know that I agree with it or I don't. I haven't had enough time, honestly, to think the action through. Certainly it startled me, but I who am not his biggest fan, for me to say, he had to think about it, and he must have had a good reason for saying it. Coming from Hallie, that's a lot, believe me.
Lisa said that that he did this in the context of partisan politics, and that a president shouldn't play partisan politics. But I think we are outside of partisan politics at this juncture in our history in this election cycle. I think Trump has taken us outside of partisan politics. He's introduced a whole new set of, you know, of variables here. The variable of, you know, mental instability, the variable of demagoguery, the variable of somebody without experience, this variable of somebody who's appealing to the extreme. extreme.
I let you have the last word on this, Lisa, because I know this is
near variable. Yeah. Demagoguery, not going to say mental illness, but extreme politics, those can come in one set of tones and one sort of rhetoric or another. And I guess I would say this. The reason Donald Trump was nominated by the vast majority of Republican primary voters is that they feel that Barack Obama, who most of us believe was also not qualified and in some ways does not have the right temperament, even though he manages to convey a beautiful, you know, beautiful acting job as president, if Barack Obama had not shaken this country up in all sorts of ways that are hurting people and making them angry, Donald Trump wouldn't be there. So I guess at this point, I see a lot of this as posturing on all sides. When you say Donald Trump has taken this outside of the realm of politics, in some ways that's true. And it is to some field that I think allows all sorts of people who are outside of the realm of politics to feel as if they are being heard or represented in a new way. Whether that's good or bad, whether he's crazy or not, isn't the issue there. The issue is that, yes, it's a whole new territory. Just one partisan comment on my part, and that is one thing you're seeing that is brand new that many Republicans have waited our life times for is somebody who swings back when he's hit.
Oh gosh, that is hardly your. I'm going to stop you right there. Hold it. I'm going to stop you there. Wait, no, Lisa, I'm going to stop you there because you already said that earlier, by the way. But that being said, here's the thing that I have to say about Barack Obama in his defense. You cannot say that Barack Obama was not qualified to be president. He was not as qualified as Hillary at the time, but remember, he had been a senator. He'd been in the legislature in Chicago. He'd been in politics all of his life. So let's not put him on the same par with Donald Trump.
And a serious man with that kind of
right.
Opinion.
At least a man who thinks. And that's one of the problems we have with Mr. Trump is that I think a lot of what you say, Lisa, is true. I understand his appeal to a certain segment of the Republican Party, but the man doesn't think. The man talks. And he doesn't think. And I think that's problematic for the president of the United States.
I agree.
And that's where I am. Okay, we're closing that one down and we're moving on. Because as long as we're going to pick on him, let's pick on Hillary. That'll make you happy, Lisa.
Okay.
Let's go to town on Hillary. And here's the thing. She got hammered. She was lucky that Trump didn't shut his mouth faster and sooner and stop the conversation, the back and forth with Khan. Because she went on Fox News and she said took to Chris Wallace. And she did what she is always does, which is she hunkered down on her whole thing with the emails. And no, she didn't lie. I mean, you know, I can give you the quote. You know, the Washington Post gave her 4 Pinocchios for what she did say.
She exonerated her, she said.
All the things that she said. So here's the thing on Hillary. Is she a serial liar? Can she stop lying?
Well,
I'm going to ask it. Wait, let me finish.
Sorry.
All right. And will her lying, and I think some of you will say she doesn't exactly lie, she parses. Will her lying bring her down? Why can't she just call it the way that it is and have, on her part, some sort of dignity in her response, not defensive in her response? And I'm going to throw this over to our good friend, who? Eeny, meeny, miny, mo, Susanna, you take it.
Oh, I knew I was going to get it. I'm going to start with the fact that she's a Scorpio. No.
I'm a Scorpio. What is that?
I think it's very deeply embedded in her personality. I'm very flummoxed by this. I understand that people are really disturbed by this, and I've worked really hard to see it from the vantage point of people who think of her as a liar, and she does. She has problems with telling the truth. I think she's immensely private. I think it's almost a very deep-seated thing. She is uncomfortable with any kind of scrutiny. And I think that's a very visceral thing. I think she hasn't learned the ropes. I will tell you one of the things that disturbs me most about her, and I am supporting her. She cannot look someone in the eye when she is being interviewed on television. That is death. And I am appalled that one of her advisors hasn't worked with her on that. That is like Mickey Mouse public speaking, right?
You've got two things going on here, Susanna. One, yes, of course, she needs better speech coaching, but she's had so much. She started off so much worse than she is. So she has made strides. The looking people in the eye, that's got to do with telling the truth. She has a hard time with that. You cannot say, as you just did, that she tells lies and her lying is deeply embedded in her personality, which I agree with 100%. And that is something that makes the entire country mistrust her, including her voters. And then say, but you just don't see why people are so concerned about it. Because really, if you know that your leaders are lying to you. To me, if they lie to you in nice tones of voice, that's actually worse than Donald Trump saying stupid things in stupid tones of voice.
All right. So let me interject here because, okay, first of all, I just read something that I hadn't even thought about, and this is going to surprise all of you. But do you know that most of the Democratic presidents for the last years are lawyers? They're all lawyers.
Yes.
I mean, the Democratic Party likes to elect lawyers. Now, there's a difference between lying and parsing. And I think parsing. No. Let me just finish. She parses. And I don't think that parsing is the same as lying. And I'm not excusing her. I'm simply saying I think her mind works differently than a lot of other people's minds. And I don't think she's different, by the way, than a lot of lawyers who all think that way. I always have trouble with lawyers because I think that they're never square. I hate to say it. They're just not. So I think it's very easy to label her as lying. But I've seen the other side of the argument on what she did on Fox News. And I also heard a lot of people say, no, you know, you can take what she said. And if you really unscramble it, what she said is really true. It's just parsing. So maybe tacking the word liar on her is the Republicans' game. Maybe it's inappropriate.
I think that's a very good point. I think there's a huge difference between parsing and lying. I was trying to make that point earlier, but I don't think that she's a liar. I don't question her motives. I think she's sincere. I think she's given her life to service to this country. I think she has genuinely good intentions and wants to do good. I think she's really actually a horrible politician. And if we're going to talk about lying, though, I mean, Donald Trump hasn't said anything true for, you know, since he started this. He exaggerates. That's a kind word for it. But he's off the charts. If we want to start using the word lying, it's got to be an equal opportunity accusation in this case, because they both are having some problems with the truth. I would argue that his are much more serious.
And I would argue the opposite. I would argue that Hillary has lied her way through everything she's ever done in her life. Do you remember in 2008 when I think it's David Geffen, the Hollywood mogul who had supported the Clintons all through the 90s, basically said, no, we're supporting Obama because the Clintons are particularly good liars. She is a good liar.
Oh, come on. I'm not going to let you get away with that. That is so not fair. That is so silly. I don't think it's fair at all because one person says it. I want to say one thing, because if this woman is as bad as you want to make her out to be, by the way, it seems unbelievable to me how many really noted, fabulous, fantastic people of great dignity were up there for her and are there for her, endorsing her, and are not endorsing Trump, who could only get his own children to speak on his behalf at his own convention. And I'm gonna jump ahead, because as long as we're on that subject, I think that this is a thought that we all ought to consider, and that is there are an awful lot of Republicans who are vowing not to vote for him, leaving the party, becoming independents, who are not standing up for him, who are going against everything he says, even if they say they are voting for him. When have we ever seen anything like that, Susanna, in politics?
Well, I'm not that old. Ha ha. No, I haven't, actually.
Screw you.
In a way, I sort of feel for them, because, you know, I feel for the ones who are caught in between and they want to have some party loyalty, and yet they're finding themselves almost every other day distancing themselves from what Trump says, and yet they can't bring themselves to unendorse him. I think this is a very difficult time for the Republican Party, and it's like there, but for the grace of God goes everyone, because it's what happens when they extreme wing of any party takes over the whole party.
This is not the extreme wing. This is a man from outside. It's not
Donald Trump is appealing to the very extreme wing. No, and as a politician,
I think you would be within your right saying that about Ted Cruz, who I would support. But that's just not true about Trump.
I think it's a very extreme wing who believes that, yes, we should build a wall. You know, I think it's absolutely legitimate to have a debate about our immigration policy. Absolutely legitimate. But building a wall, I think it's extreme to say we're going to keep the Muslims out. I don't even think he believes all of this. He has been pro-choice until he ran for office.
Okay, let me interject here, because here's something that comes to my mind about him that I find, and I want you to explain this to me, Lisa, because I can't understand it. But you have to say that this guy is not the most intelligent in terms of policy. He hasn't shown any desire to learn anything about policy. He's all over the place from morning, noon, and night. He does not have a moral code invested in who he is. He goes with the wind. The moralistic Republican Party, the Christian right-dominated Republican Party, here's what I have a problem with, that they would even endorse him, particularly after what he did. I mean, all the bad things that he's done. But when he starts making fun of people who are physically impaired, I don't get this. Explain. And you, because I love you. I know how smart you are. I know what a good person you are. I don't understand how you overlook. So some very real problems with this man and morality.
I'm going to say exactly what any evangelical would say right now.
Okay, tell me.
A, we always love being complimented on our intelligence before being told it's inconceivable, therefore, that we think what we think.
I don't even get that. Do you get that, Susanna? I don't get that.
You don't get that? It's like saying, you're so smart, you can't possibly believe this. But I do. I believe something that I get that you guys don't understand. Every awful thing you think about Trump and his flaws, it's not as if I am blind to those things, but you are blind to what we see in Hillary and the direction we think she'll take this country. I think all of those evangelicals that you talk about, they want no part of, you know, his personal morality.
Here's what the evangelicals believe, and this is Franklin Graham speaking at the First Baptist Church in Jacksonville, Florida in January 2015. The American dream ended on November 6, 2012 in Ohio. The second term of Barack Obama has been the final nail in the coffin for the legacy of the white Christian males who discovered, explored, pioneered, settled, and developed the greatest republic in the history of mankind, a coalition of blacks, Latinos, feminists, gays, government workers, union members, environmental extremists, the media, Hollywood, uninformed young people, the forever needy, the chronically unemployed.
All right, I think we get the gist.
Aliens and other fellow travelers have ended America.
Lisa, you can't ignore that kind of statement. But honest to God, I think the difference between Hillary and Trump, number one, besides one being qualified to do the job. You may not like her. You may think she's a liar, but she is certainly qualified in public policy and governance.
First of all, I would actually argue with you point by point on what she has accomplished in her career.
I didn't say accomplished. I said qualified, and there's a big difference between accomplished and qualified. She understands the workings of government, and I think that Donald Trump hasn't a clue. We can tell by the way he responds. He put the whole country at risk with the crap about the emails and telling Putin, and don't tell me he was kidding, because he was not kidding.
He was joking.
He was not joking. Oh my gosh.
That Putin has her emails. Putin has her emails because she's careless, which is yet another.
That is not even funny. That is not a funny statement to make, because the rest of the world does not pick up on Donald Trump's quote unquote, which I don't believe it was true, New York sense of humor. And he puts the entire world into a schism. And that is absolutely inappropriate for the man who's running to be the leader of the free world. Sorry, I don't get myself exercised, but I am exercised now because I just think it's dangerous the way some people are letting this play because they are worried about the Supreme Court. That's the new line this week.
Let's just go back to your question, which was, how can people like me and the right support Donald Trump, given his flaws? And the answer is, and again, there are a million ways of construing Hillary's policy plans and her past actions that I don't think my liberal friends understand. I think you have two things. One, the media has shielded her for a very, very long time from...
I don't buy that. Susanna.
It's off the reservation.
Right. It's crazy. That's just silly.
She has been under assault by the media for, 20 years?
Right. I mean, she's been
James Comey absolved her, as she said to Chris Wallace, of
James Comey was doing what he was not supposed to do. You either indict or you shut your mouth as a prosecutor. I don't know. He was playing politics himself.
I'll tell you what I think James Comey was doing, just as a sidebar. I think what he was doing was avoiding a real critical crisis, because if you took Hillary out of the race, I mean he understood that he was in an untenable position one way or the other, whether he thought she was, on the other hand, I agree with his findings, because I don't think that there was ever any there, and I think this was just trumped up, and that's the way that I think. But I did understand the position that he was in, because it was kind of like Gore v. Gore, and that, you know, that will forever reverberate.
He was put in that position partly by Bill Clinton and on the plane with Loretta Lynch, right?
Well, you can say all of those things, but I think that those things are not things that play in politics. They do. And we have to understand that they do. They're a part of politics.
Let's go back to one of Trump's totally outrageous points of view, and that is his view that we should not let in people from Arab and other Muslim countries in the middle of, you know, wars that are essentially about fanatic Islam.
Wait, Lisa, you've misstated it. He started out by saying he would not let in Muslims.
Okay.
And then he has amended it under pressure to say it's regional, not religious.
But it doesn't even matter, because you know what? A, the Constitution actually allows for Congress to set pretty much any standard it wants with regard to who they allow in as immigrants. So that's one point. And two, this is so not an outlier point of view. The numbers on this point of view range from 75% in favor across the board, including Democrats, on up. Most people look at Europe and they see this mess that revolves very much around refugees and migrants from Syria and Libya and Africa, and they don't want to bring that here. And Hillary,
regional policy might make sense, but that's not what caused the conflict. He talked about Muslims generally. That's a difference.
Let me jump in here for a second, because let me say this, okay? In the beginning, he was barring everybody from, he didn't care where they were coming from, and let's call it for what it was, and that's what it was. Now, I'm going to surprise you, Lisa. I'm going to say to you, I understand the concept of where he was going with this. He was saying, we are not being smart. We've got to be very careful about how we gauge who is a person who might be of danger to us versus who is not. That's really what he wanted to say. I really believe in his heart of heart, maybe that's what he wanted to say. And of course, because he's not presidential material, he just winged out and, you know, whatever. And he saw that a lot of people went, yeah, let's stop those Muslims coming in the country. The bottom line, there is nothing wrong than saying, because Israel has certainly proven it, and Israel profiles, and we would do ourselves a whole lot of good, by the way, by following Israel's model than the one that we have right now, which is so cost ineffective besides being not effective. I understand that. And I understand that we maybe have to relook how we are dealing with. I mean, we don't want to be Germany, which is a mess, but that's where he was going. But it tells you he is not quick enough on his feet, not smart enough, not nimble enough to be able to say things that need to be said in a way that we can all accept them and understand them.
He's not verbally nimble in the manner of a lawyer. But I also believe...
No, I didn't say that. You said that. He's not verbally nimble. Wait a minute. He's not verbally nimble in the way of a president, period.
Maybe. But if the model is all of these lawyers who are precisely verbally nimble and able to parse things. To me, that leads us to a lot more problems and half-truths and deception.
Well, I don't know. You know what? I still think that the United States of America is one heck of a country. And, you know, right. We're doing all right and we're not falling apart at the seams and we're not blowing up into smithereens by these people. We've pretty much, you know, kept it contained.
I don't think that Donald Trump is inarticulate. I think he's very nimble in his speech when he cares and when he's talking about something that genuinely interests him.
You think he is? I've never heard of him.
My concern with Donald Trump here is that he doesn't really care. This is a game. He's having fun. It's a competition. Is he going to win?
I don't know if I buy that. Oh, that's a guess. I don't know if that's true either.
Tell you what my impression.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That'll accept.
That's perfect.
That's fair. That's totally fair. It was impression. Now, before we go, guys, there is one that I have to pick up on, and we are going to do this. The New York Post has released a series of naked photos of could-be First Lady Melania Trump. Now, for those listening, if you want an earful, visiting the Hallie Kessler Jane Show group page on Facebook, you guys want to go there because our fellow broads have been yakking up about this one, something fierce, and it's hysterical. You have to see all the people. We've been having a blast, but we wanted to also save some of it for a conversation during the show today, and that's what we're doing. And about these photos, Sheila, first of all, in your life, do images like these disqualify her for the role of First Lady? I'm going to ask you a whole bunch of questions at once,
sure.
And then have at it. Should they be used against her? To say that, would that be slut-slamming Melania Trump? And where would be feminists be on this issue? I mean, have we ever had this happen, a future First Lady naked?
We never had this happen, but the closest thing was, I mean, I'm being sarcastic here, the right-wingers saying, how dare Michelle Obama wear a sleeveless dress? First of all, it looks like slut-shaming, and my Facebook friends, the feminists on, said, let's leave this alone, including somebody I think we all know who lives in New Jersey, who's a fabulous Facebooker, and she goes after the Kardashians, she goes after Amal Clooney. She said, let's leave this one alone. This isn't fair. She was a down-on-her-luck model from Slovenia, and she did these nude pictures, and now they're dogging her. Then after 2 days, there was one with the nude pictures, then one with kind of the lesbian breast pictures. The Trumps did not complain about this. Melania had jumped up and down to the GQ writer about an interview. They weren't that bothered by this. So it went from the do not slut-shame her, how terrible to that. What's weird about this is that the Trumps aren't complaining and the New York Post is not a liberal media paper. Why did they do this aside from obviously selling a lot of copies? And then you have Pat Robertson saying, well, she's a very attractive woman. She's a very beautiful woman. And this is art. Now, this is Pat Robertson who said, I think he said something like 9/11 was punishment for gays. This is so, if anybody is pandering in the most beyond hypocritical way. So have we ever seen this? No, we have never seen this. We've never seen a would-be first lady who's had a situation like this.
You know, first lady isn't a real job.
It isn't a real job, but it is. It's an honorary position. It's an earned position. You even said on last week's show something about the fact that, that Michelle didn't even earn her stripes to be, to have the gratuitous, if you will, that wasn't the word you used, the great job of being first lady. So don't fall on that one.
But here's what I think. As a mother of three teenage girls.
Yeah, that would be concerning.
Forever yelling out to button up. Of course, this isn't what you would want ideally, but we live in the most promiscuous society. Of course, it's not a question. These are stupid pictures and it was a bad decision and not everybody would have made it. Having said all that, everybody in that business would have made it. And we are a promiscuous and visual society where this sort of thing is fairly commonplace. I kind of agree with Sheila that it's very hard to hold this against her because it was so common. Now, I want to say this. I find the woman appalling in lots and lots of ways, but I have been a little bit touched by the gravity with which she is approaching her position as a mother and secondarily as a wife and her clear desire to be, you know, to have some dignity to cling to. And you know what? The slut shaming thing, I usually don't buy that. I'm happy to shame the people who are behaving shamefully. But this was 25 years ago. I would let it go. Yeah.
Nobody's against her. I'm not shaming her. It's them. Can you elect a president whose wife did this? I'm sorry, we have a country. You say it's promiscuous, it's visual. Sorry, we've never done this before. Never
right.
had a divorced first lady before. Wasn't Kitty Dukakis?
No. Nancy, wasn't Nancy Reagan divorced?
Nancy Reagan was, yes.
Yeah.
Hollywood.
Yeah.
My old Hollywood. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. And again, the right wing made an exception for him. In fact, somebody was on from one of the right, a pastor was on and said, we had a very nobly, totally married evangelical Jimmy Carter, but he ran against Ronald Reagan, who was a doubly married, you know, Hollywood guy, and we voted for politics.
I'm going to interject here because, you know, to me, it's slippery slope. I can't believe I'm saying this, but I am going to say it. Kim Kardashian, I hate everything that she's done. I hate the whole concept of every little girl looking at her and she's, you know, she thinks it's fun to bare her boobs. I don't think it's fun. And I think at some point we have to draw a line here. What becomes commonplace doesn't necessarily mean it's an okay thing to do. Little girls looking at these photos of this woman naked when she's the First Lady of the United States, I am sorry. But given all of that, Donald Trump has hung her out to dry twice. The plagiarism thing, I'm going to finish. I let you all talk. Let me just finish what I was going to say. He let her on the plagiarism thing for 3 days, hang out there and do nothing and said nothing because they didn't know quite how to handle it until finally, 72 hours, they came through with some kind of crap to get the plagiarism story shut down. One of the conversations we had in that whole dialogue on Facebook was, where's Donald Trump? Why haven't they said anything? And everybody is trying to figure out whether he released the pictures to get him out. Who cares? Who knows? But I will say this. He did not come to the defense of his wife quickly enough. I think today or yesterday late, he might have said something.
The pictures speak for themselves. There's what can you say in the face of them? And let me just say, this is one of those moments where instead of saying something violent or ugly or threatening to hurt people, he has shut up. That might be the better part of valor. These pictures
he always knew they were out
real.
There. There was no surprise to them. They both knew that those pictures were out. It was a question of when it came out.
Them. I'm sorry.
No,
well, he may have. We'll never know. It's a silly conversation because we don't know.
I actually talked to the editor of the editorial page of the Post today who thinks this is ridiculous. No, it did not happen. And no, it's not helping or hurting him.
That's nothing. What's interesting is that the Khan thing has hurt him. That's so puzzling and fascinating to me. An angry Muslim man hurts him bipartisanly. That's just sort of
interesting. I think it's because he's the first. I do. The reason, because when you said that to me earlier today, you know what my thought is on that, Sheila, because I really thought about it. It's because he's so dignified. You can't argue with a man who is so dignified.
It's about image. He is dignified in a way that the Benghazi mom.
Right, exactly.
That is not content. That is image. And let me say this. I think every time Donald Trump brings up problems with Muslim immigration, whether in this man's person or in some, you know, more direct sense, it helps him because that's an issue that lots of people are going to the polls for him about.
Well, he's playing to his masses, but that doesn't help him in one sense because he can't win with just Republicans. He's got to get the center. And guess what? I think he's alienated a lot of people over the last week in the center. And I think, I know, because you could look at Hillary's poll. She's starting to break into that white male, uneducated, blue-collar guy that was purely Trump. And the polls are starting to show that she's making headway. I saw it today. So I think that it is starting to cost him a little bit on all of that. With that, ladies, I got to say, guess what? We're over. We're done.
Over.
We're finished. Oh, my gosh. Till next time. Good night, Susanna.
Good night, Hallie. It was great. Good night, everyone.
Say good night, Sheila.
Good night. Good night, everybody. It was fun.
Say good night, Lisa.
Good night, and have a great week.
Thanks so much for tuning in to the Hallie Kasser Jane Show, a production of RSX LLC. Associate producer, Suzanne Probst. Music by Tony Rizal Jazz. Visit HallieKasserJane.com.